Hey everybody, welcome to another episode from Daniel's Month as we talk about the notorious League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I promise I limited him to ranting about the comic for only a little bit. But this is an excellent episode and a fun movie to make fun of, and I hope you enjoy. In the meantime, if you have not yet, please rate and review us wherever you get us. It keeps us on the charts. And I would love to see some new reviews. It's been a bit. But in the meantime, I want to thank you for listening and sharing. It keeps us in doubt. Bye, everyone. Welcome to Myopia Movies. This week, we're still finishing our Dantastic month, and we are doing the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, an Alan Moore inspired movie. Though I believe by this point his name is in the credits, but he's not taking credit anymore, and I believe he gives all the money to the artist that he worked with. But this is the killer of careers, the destroyer of studios. This was a huge financial flop, and we're here to talk about it. This is, if you recall, Daniel's kind of formula was he wanted to do a movie. I think everyone wanted to talk about with people, a movie that he hadn't seen but knew was dumb, and this is the one that he truly hated that he wanted other people to talk about.
I'm your host, Nick
Hoffman, and on panel we, of course, have Daniel.
Hello, this is Daniel, and I don't even have a joke here. Oh, dear Lord, this movie.
We got Nor.
Nor Trinette. I now know if Liberace had a submarine, what would it look like?
And of course, we've got Matt, who you heard laughing right there.
Who actually liked this movie. Sorry, Daniel.
Yes.
Them's fighting words there, buddy.
Conflict.
Yeah. We'll obviously go through this movie. I wanted to kind of give a little bit of a opening screed here. I promised Daniel he could. So this is about a graphic novel. I would say when we're talking Alan Moore, we're pretty much always talking graphic novels. But give us a little bit about why this raised so much ire for you.
Well, it raised ire for me when I first saw it, because I remember reading about how everyone hated it. I know Roger Ebert gave it one of his worst reviews, or maybe not quite one of his worst reviews, but he just eviscerated it. And I saw it because back then, you know, you see whatever's in theaters when you're a carefree teenager. And oh boy, I walked out of that because I was still kind of learning that movies can be horrendously bad. I walked out of that just wondering what I'd witnessed. So I read the comic later. I'm sorry, go ahead, Matt.
No, I was saying, how old were you when you watched this movie?
Oh, when it was out in theaters, I was probably 15.
Okay.
Yeah, it came out in 2003, so soon after I graduated high school.
I read the comic later, and Alan Moore is a very weird guy, but he's a very smart guy. And I'm not going to turn this into a, oh, well, this is how it went in the comic versus this is how it went in the movie, because you can find that elsewhere. The comics are, you can get a good price for a digital copy on Amazon these days. So go read them. Go check them out if you want to. But the biggest thing about them is that the references in the book, and it's the same plot, a bunch of 19th century pulp fiction characters get together like the Avengers to solve mysteries. They're intelligent. Like, you have to reread them, and eventually you might be like, oh, that bust in this panel on this page has the name Lemuel Gulliver on it. That's interesting. So Lemuel Gulliver exists in this universe. And I think at one point, I'm actually looking at the Wikipedia here, they incorporated characters from Infinite Jest. And I know they've incorporated things from Thomas Pynchon, and you have to really pay attention to get that. This movie has no faith in its audience. It explains every single joke and reference it's making. And it is so annoying.
Fair.
Yeah.
This movie treats us all like we're very dumb. That's true. Sorry, Nar, go ahead.
But it looks good.
There were some good effects. I think especially the scene where they're driving through downtown Venice in the weird car, like, and smashing up the town. Like, that looked good.
In automobile. Wait, so hold on. I just want to ask this topic, Keith, because I didn't really grow up listening to Roger Ebert. What was so special about this dude?
Oh, I mean, he's just the reviewer to people. Yeah. Go ahead.
You don't remember Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down? He and Siskel had their own TV show. Later, it was Richard Roper after Siskel died.
The first time I ever listened or concerned myself with Robert Ebert was during the Godzilla movie. And it wasn't good, but he said it was good, but it wasn't good. So I was very conflicted to listen to this man.
Which one? The one from 98? Because he hated that one too.
The one that, hold up. Yeah, the one with Matthew Broderick?
Yeah. No, he gave that a... if I recall correctly, and I've got his books, I've read them probably far more than any human should, but if I recall correctly, and I am semi-quoting here, Godzilla closed the Cannes Film Festival for the same reason that horses are the last thing in the Macy's Day Thanksgiving Parade. Thanksgiving Day Parade.
Okay. It's more art. Okay.
Other words, there's shit everywhere afterwards.
I've been holding a gripe on Roger Ebert for it since the year 2000s. Then, okay. Thank you for resolving a 23-year-old.
Happy to help.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
What's up? So long as I've got you, was this the first time you saw the movie?
No. I was telling Nick, I watched it first on FX. You know, the straightforward too, and for mm-hmm. me. The what, 2003? So I was kind of in junior high, elementary school. we're just playing with it. It was dope because the only thing that I really picked up on was that, was it Tom Sawyer? Tom Sawyer, he was actually one of the characters because we just read them in school. So that was the only character that I really picked up on. And of course, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. Mm-hmm. So for me, this was like, seeing the transformation, even that, but also even no spoilers towards the end, but like just seeing just like the practical effect, but also with the CGI, like I thought this movie is really dope. Now, rewatching it now, I can just, in knowing what pacing is, knowing what, you know, good storytelling is, what, you know, what good writing is, it confused me, but practically, yeah. Pretty good, but
Well, Tom Sawyer is actually an addition to the movie, and I said I wasn't going to go through this, but Dorian Gray and Tom Sawyer aren't in the comics at all. They might be referenced. I might be wrong there, but they're not part of the league.
So basically, they Legolas is it because Legolas wasn't in the Hobbit books, but he was in the Hobbit movie. Is that
well? He was. Yeah, kind of. They wanted an American character because Alan Moore is very English, and he references American pop culture, but he obviously doesn't like it.
I wonder if the studio was like, no, just to your point, like, we need an American actor. We also need a heartthrob, and we also need something to attract the youth. So let's get Shane mm-hmm. Wet. You know what I mean? Like, because that was the only, besides Sean Connery, that was the only person I like legit knew who he was because I was a teen. You know,
sure.
I watched. Well,
even so, if you're making an adaptation of this material, it's not a bad idea to include Tom Sawyer or Dorian Gray. Matt, was this the first time you saw this movie?
No, I saw it and it came out in theaters.
Did you like it then?
I think so.
Really? I find this so annoying. Okay.
Why?
Well, I mean, Daniel was kind of talking about the pedantic reasons, which is that they treat us like idiots. But The pacing on this movie is atrocious. There's an action scene, but then when the action scene is done, it's just talking for 20 minutes at a time. And then there's action and there's talking. There's no flow to this movie.
That's called
go ahead.
It's called what?
It's called dialoguing.
Yeah, it is.
Well, and the characters aren't that deep either. I mean, they're in their source material, and by that I mean the original novels that they're from, they're a lot deeper and more engaging, but here it's just the archetypes. I mean, Alan Quartermain is the old adventurer who doesn't want to go on another adventure. Tom Sawyer is the surrogate son figure to him. Mina Harker is the woman who's trying to stand up for herself in a group of men. And the Invisible Man is the one you can't trust. I mean, it's so basic.
Yeah.
I don't know of another word to describe it.
Well, they spend a lot of the first part of the movie, you think the Invisible Man is a traitor. It turns out he's not.
Yeah, but that's so undeserved, right? Like, they think he's a scumbag because he's a thief. Fine, whatever. But then he just turns out he's not. It's just, there's no discovery. There's no, oh my goodness, he was innocent and helping us. No, he just dicked off and wandered naked through the snow for presumably days. It just, none of this mattered. And that's what bothers me. It also keeps, it also gets basic stuff wrong, which I know is not wrong in the book, but it shows this modicum of we don't have to bother. For example, you don't tend to make tanks out of iron, make them out of steel. So why is it talking about iron factories the whole time? Why is this like, it just, all these little things are so dumb. And you know what? You can just say magic. I'm not going to care.
Yeah.
But like, things like the Nautilus seem to grow and shrink depending on the scene. Sometimes it's 30 feet tall, bigger than the Titanic. Sometimes it's so small, can fit through the Grand Canal of Venice. Venice isn't that big of a place. Like,
yeah.
And of course, things like Mr. Hyde and then the Abomination at the end, it literally just recreates the fight scene from Incredible Hulk that came out just a couple years before. That looks awful.
It does.
You know, and so, like,
fair.
Go ahead.
To be fair, some of that more ridiculous stuff was in Alan Moore's book. But, I mean, there it's like, oh, okay, because it's supposed to be an equal to the Hulk and to that airship that the Avengers have. So you kind of understood what they were doing. And in this case, it's just like nothing else was happening. So I was so distracted. It's like, wait, how is the Nautilus going through the Venetian canals? And why is there a graveyard in Venice all of a sudden?
Right. All these little things which don't matter that they add to it to make it feel like it has weight. Because what they're trying to do is, well, they can't decide what they're trying to do. But effectively, it's a Bond plot starring the Avengers, which Daniel said is more or less what the book is. Problem is, you could just simplify it. But instead, it's all this nonsense to get simple answers. Like, you don't have to fly across the world several times on the Nautilus, right? Like, I get it. It's more, the problem is what I've just heard Kevin Smith describe as the Weinstein problem, which is that sometimes they just get a movie because it has a cool idea and then ignore all the important stuff about the IP because it's a cool idea, and that's it. World War Z is a classic example where the book is very well defined, incredibly well received, but they just bought the rights for the title and the fact that zombies are in it and then made a movie that's completely different. And that's what this smells of to me. Like, they're just like, oh, the Avengers is going to come out soon. We're already building up these worlds. Let's just take advantage of the fact that people know what the X-Men are and use it with something that's essentially a public domain thing. So we can do.
So you're saying this is an Asylum production?
Basically, it's kind the of. Asylum Avengers.
That made one of my favorite actors stop acting. So, you know, I'm going to hate it no matter what.
Let's talk about that. No, with Sean Connery and stuff, right? It's like, and by the way, I'm very disappointed in the, this is Sean Connery and no one has done an impression. Nick, I'm looking at you.
I'll do it.
This movie is not actually a box office bomb because it made nearly three times its budget.
What sort of impression are you suggesting we do, laddie?
Are you happy now?
No, I'm not.
Sometimes you need to get that. Yo, I remember there was an interview with Sean Connery and he like justified hitting women. Anyways.
Oh, yeah.
no, so like.
Just a good slap every once in a while.
Yeah, lady slap.
Yeah. I was just like, yo, this man's wild. But then again, I would think John Wayne was probably racist, but you know, that was just his era. Anyways.
Probably. There was no probably about that there, Nor.
Anyways, so let's talk.
He did an interview with Playboy once. It's the most racist shit you can imagine.
And I'm sure at the times it wasn't shocking. but no. So if I'm not mistaken, this movie when it came out, 2003, The Matrix, 1999. And if I'm not mistaken, Sean Connery was offered to play Morpheus, which is Lauren Fishburne's characters in The Matrix. And he said no because... And I paraphrase, quote this, I don't understand this. So I guess in his defense, he approached this movie, didn't understand it, thought it was the next Matrix, which I can understand because I still don't understand the Matrix. And then they fucking came out with that fourth one, which made me even more confused. I'm sure I feel like he just gave up because things didn't make sense anymore. And I guess this is the era of like, the studios and shit trying to be like franchising on superheroes. So well, I guess to y'all's point, they saw a cheap IP and, you know, said like, hey, let's do it.
Well, that's right, Nora, but that's only half the story. He was also offered the role of Gandalf in the Lord of the Rings, but he didn't understand the script. So he turned it down. And both The Matrix and Lord of the Rings were huge successes. I think he could have gotten like $200 million all told if he had accepted Gandalf.
Yeah.
So then he thought, he also was in The Avengers, which was an absolute mess. I think we did that on Mission Briefing at one point, Nick.
And I believe it's come out on the main feed. If not,
it not the soon. Marvel Avengers, but one based on the 60s show.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
For those of you who aren't in the know in Radio Land,
with Uma Thurman and Ralph Fiennes, and it was a mess.
That's unwatchable. And yeah,
that was a huge bomb. And he did a couple things between Avengers and here, including a movie I liked, Finding Forrester. I'm not sure if anyone else remembers that.
I know the line. You're the man now, dog.
Yes, that movie. Busta Rhymes is also in that movie.
Which what is the movie with him in that red bikini in the wasteland that looked like Dune?
Zardoz,
which is a really good film.
The gun is good, and the penis is evil.
Have you seen it, man?
Sean Connery's character.
Oh, well, I guess you should do the voice anyway. Damn it!
Yeah.
No, I haven't.
When people
seen
do
the
Godfather and they give everyone what's his name's voice,
Marlon Brando's.
Wasn't personal, just business.
That's right.
I can't do impressions. I can't do.
You're not talking with golf balls in your mouth. That's the problem.
Cotton balls.
Oh, well, anyway.
Golf balls. I'll use paper towels. but nah, so like, I can. And if you think about it, like, everyone watches interviews about actors and they get like mountains, especially if it's Sean Connery, you probably get mountains of scripts left and right. And so, I mean, you got an hour to read it and you got to say yes or no. So I guess he still
He didn't understand The Matrix or Lord of the Rings. He didn't understand the script to this either, but he signed on because he thought that then it would be a huge hit. And he hated working with the director of this movie, Steve Norrington, who also directed previous episode Blade.
Yeah.
Mm.
And then he directed this, and then nothing, no feature film since this.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier in my previous Sean Connery voice, this movie didn't really bomb. It made about just under three times its budget.
No, okay, that's not completely true. So it cost $78 million to make, but the advertisement on it was almost $35 to $40 million. So we're talking $120 million, and then it only globally made $180. Now,
the almighty wiki says about 50 million, 46 to 50 million DVD sales.
Yeah, but that's not what gets sequels back then. Like nowadays, we consider it, but that's DVD sales over 15 years. That's not all it was. And so, like, what Daniel said is true. It essentially killed the director's career. It killed a bunch of these actors' career. Like, this is not a successful movie. And the reviews were atrocious. Like, and what's funny is they talked about other movies with similar bad reviews. I read this article in LA Times. But similarly, not as bad, but also with bad reviews, was Pirates of the Caribbean. But Pirates of the Caribbean made almost $200 million in the U.S. alone, and then globally made $500 million. So, like, this movie is at the time when the X-Men are making huge profits. This, like, I mean, this came out the same year as the second Matrix movie and as Pirates.
And I believe the second X-Men movie.
I thought second X-Men was 2002.
Well, let's take a look real quick.
But yeah, I
you
mean,
might we're be talking... right. It was around the same time,
right? And it made
the first X-Men movie when I was learning how to drive. So I think the second one might have been when I was still in high school. So around this time,
right? 2003, apparently.
Oh, there you go. And so we get from this that I don't know. I think this was the wrong IP to do, but frankly, I'm trying to even think now. Of the Alan Moore movies, the one that probably looks the best is Watchmen, but he is like a boutique novelist, and they just don't seem to get it right.
Yeah, I mean, Watchmen still isn't good compared to the comic. V for Vendetta really isn't all that great. The comic's a lot deeper. From Hell, I think I saw about 20 minutes of it on cable at one point, so I can't really comment, but... I don't remember it being that great.
I remember From Hell. I didn't know it was a comic adaptation. I thought it was like a detective movie.
No, I will say, hold on. I had a cotton ball, not cotton ball, but half a paper towel in my mouth. I'm gonna do my breath.
Sure. You're gonna be the Godfather now?
No, I don't know. Anyways, I had Bounty in my mouth. Anyways, I will say this about Watchmen. I think the movie was just way ahead of its time. I still think it's a good movie.
I was gonna say also the effects were way ahead of its time. I like just the way they did a lot of it. Manhattan, Dr. Manhattan, just like the way that he glowed through the scene, like it looked incredible. You know, and for a movie that's 14 years old, the effects mostly hold up.
I'd rather have that movie than Batman v Superman. Just saying.
You know, that movie, it looks good, but that was one where they made the opposite mistake of this, where it was tied too closely to the source material. So the Watchmen series that's on HBO is actually much better, even though it has no connection to the comics whatsoever.
Yo, anything with race? I'm kidding. No, that show is like Regina George. She does her thing in that whole thing. We should probably
parts of it filmed in Decatur Square. So there you go.
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to stop us here for a second. I'm going to give you the plot because none of us have done this yet.
I was about to say.
Smash cut to good old colonial racism, where we're told that, you know what? Africa loves Alan Quatermain. I have more fans on Facebook in Africa, you know, this place just called Africa, than anywhere else.
I bless the range down in Africa.
Pretty much. Meanwhile, he has like a handler who gets drunk in the corner because a member of the Queen's Guard is there to protect him. Why is he needed? Well, because the cold open is a tank from World War I, a British tank, driving through the walls of the Bank of England and stealing a book, which is a badly Xeroxed copy of some sketches that Da Vinci did, which, God help me, like, it's like 17th century medicine where they're like, you know who nailed it? The Romans. This is like, you know who's the only architect we can trust? Someone who's been dead for 300 years. So a guy in an iron mask blows up the wall. They steal all this stuff. They kill a bunch of cops, and the movie gets going. Then the next hour of this pretty much is a let's get the gang back together thing. We get Alan Quatermain, who is played by Sean Connery, who is, for those of you who are not British or seen any mediocre movies from the 80s, He is kind of sort of who Indiana Jones is based on. He's a treasure hunter. He's an explorer. Oh. And he is one hell of a good shot.
Sorry to interrupt, Nick. Do you remember when Canon released Alan Quartermain movies in the 80s?
Yeah, there were two, right? There was
I saw both of them.
There were.
Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, King Solomon's Mines. I saw that one. And there's a second movie. I can't remember the title.
It was
back when there was that video store by the Kroger. I rented at least one of them from there.
For all of those of you who know our Kroger, you'll know what he's talking about. And then from there, the rest of the cast is an Indian actor by the name of I'm gonna get this wrong and I apologize. Nasiruddin Shah playing Captain Nemo, the captain of the Nautilus from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. We've got Peter Wilson playing Mina Harker, who is she's here, a chemist. Turns out she's a vampire, in case you didn't guess that. But she is given vampiric powers from the book Dracula. Rodney Skinner, who, since the guy dies at the end of The Invisible Man, he is a thief who steals the formula for the invisibility potion from The Invisible Man. We have Dorian Gray, played by Stuart Townsend, who I will get back to in a second. Shane West playing Tom Sawyer, based on the American books Tom Sawyer Detective and Tom Sawyer Abroad, though not in The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. And Jason Fleming, who plays Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. They're sent on their mission by a guy named M, because there is Bond references throughout the books as well. But their mission is to stop the man in the mask, the Phantom, appropriately, again, from the French
book. How very operatic.
Yeah, exactly. Because he's trying to start World War I. He's doing incredible explosives and heists in London and in Berlin to essentially trigger war based on an arms race that he's going to provide for, which kind of presupposes something like the Cold War, or I guess Iran-Contra, where the weapons maker is actually triggering war by selling weapons to everyone else. And I'll kind of stop there. And just to kind of throw it out here, they spend a lot of time building up these characters. We have, you know, all of them kind of meet in this room with M, the Invisible Man, Nemo, and Mina Harker, but they have to collect Dorian Gray. Tom Sawyer is like a looky-loo who's kind of figured it all out already, sort of. He's the detective type who's just outside. And they have to then catch Dr. Jekyll / Mr. Hyde. Now, this is kind of, if it was a book, this is the book you give to the AP kids because they should get these references. As a movie, it's the one that you give the kids who grew up watching Wishbone because they don't remember shit. Like, the problem
what's Wishbone for those who don't know?
The one with the little dog.
What was that?
My Sweet Summer Child. When you're having a day where you're eating gummies that make you feel better about yourself.
Look up
Wishbone. I believe it's on HBO Max because a lot of that stuff got bought up. It's a PBS show, but they retold the classics for kids in 22-minute segments. But the main character was always a Yorkshire Terrier, I think, by the name of Wishbone.
Jack Russell Terrier, I think.
A Jack Russell, thank you. So, like, he was Romeo playing against a girl playing Juliet. He was Sherlock Holmes in Hound of the Baskervilles. He was Huck Finn in the Adventures of Huck Finn. And it was like a 90s show that came on after Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego. Matt, go ahead.
He was King David at one point. They did like a version of Goliath. So you get to see a little dog chucking a rock at somebody and killing him.
There you go.
So I just don't want to sound dumb here. So this is the Tom Sawyer from the Huckleberry Finn Adventures, right?
Yeah, he appears in four books.
So where was Huck Finn?
Well, he appears in four books, and the one that you probably read was The Adventures of Huck Finn, because Huck Finn historically is an interesting book.
Very uncomfortable for me to read that in an all-white school.
100%. No, I get you. So the first book is Tom Sawyer, and Tom Sawyer, the book, is like standard kind of book about kids. They play pranks on each other. he, you know, famously at the end of the book, he pretends to be dead so he can watch their own funeral. Like, it's, yeah. He's a prankster. Like, it's a goof. The second one, they focus more on his young kind of poor kid buddy, Huck Finn. And right. Huck Finn was going to be a book like that, where he runs down the river with his a slave he's helping escape named Jim. And then the last third of the book makes no sense, which is there was a bunch of like con men on the road that tricked them and tried to sell Jim back into slavery. Okay.
The Royal Nonsuch, you mean?
The Royal Nonsuch, exactly.
And where was Jim in this movie? Is he referenced at all in the stories after?
Well, Jim was a friend of Huck, not Tom.
Yeah exactly.
Gotcha.
So after the second book, it goes back to focusing on Tom Sawyer, where he gets a taste for kind of adventuring. He gets adopted by that rich woman at the end of the second book, and she takes him to Europe, where he goes around Europe and gets in kind of inside this world of intrigue and like becomes kind of this member of, you know, not quite Scotland Yard, but he's that dude. And so the fourth book is literally called Tom Sawyer Detective, where he goes around solving crimes. And so, like I said, being a Southerner with a six shooter and, you know, this world of intrigue in Europe actually fits. So I don't have a problem with this. The problem for me is that it would be interesting if we picked one of these characters and focused on them. Right. But even our star, and by the way, of that $78 million budget that Matt was quoting, Sean Connery got $18 million of it just out of pocket.
Good Lord.
So, like, that explains probably some of the effects where you're just like, there's not a lot of money for the rest of it because Sean is literally making almost one out of every $4 that they spent on this whole thing. But yeah, so that's what that is. Go ahead, buddy. No,
just in a sense, as a student, I much rather had learned the adventures of him in Europe rather than reading The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn.
I think this is not me crapping on English teachers. It's just me saying that in general, they sometimes pick books for their significance in a cultural perspective much more than they are interesting. And so I think Huck Finn is a historically critical book, but parts of it are very boring. The parts of it that are significant are very brief. Like when Huck is having a moral decision as to he's been raised in the South, so doing anything to help a slave is sinful and he doesn't want to go to hell, but he realizes that helping Jim is worth going to hell for. That's incredible character development for someone writing before the Civil War happened. And then it goes on to a bunch of merry pranksters and it's just like, come on, Twain. You know?
No, true. But like even a movie that follows him and just and from that descent to even up to the point to this so-called Avengers movie, which would have been a much more interesting story. Like even if you had a story individually of how things came about, like they basically Justice League us, you know, in a sense, you know, they just expected us to know the backstory of all these characters and, you know, commonality. Like, okay, it's dope that I call it Forrest Gumping, where they infringed on a certain historical time period and be like, yo, this could have happened. You know what I mean? That's what the King's Man did, coincidentally, you know, around that time period too, you know, at the start of World War One. But yeah, no, that's like, ugh.
Well, to your credit,
that's more. Go ahead, Nick.
I will say something really quick and then Daniel, you can jump in here, but the King's Man and the King's Men movies know that they're stupid, so they lean into it so it's more fun. There's something about this where the movie still wants to act like it's smart, right? Like you have a bunch of like, as though Sean Connery has read all the cliff notes, he's like, I thought he died in that explosion. And you're just like, oh. Or I mean, like, or when M goes, Moriarty died at Rickenbach Falls, I'm like, who cares? If this was a Sherlock Holmes movie, then yes, everyone should know that. But here we're talking about 40 different intellectual properties, and guess what? No one's paying attention. They're not. Sudsy, go ahead.
Well, Nor mentioned that this movie is force gumping everything by expecting us to know the backstory. That's more true with the source material, where they expect you to recognize some of the Easter eggs they throw in, but you can still understand the plot and who the characters are because they massively revise them. Like Mina Murray isn't a vampire, but she is somebody who encountered Dracula, and they acknowledge that she was bit. This movie is just a lot stupider in that it has to explain every single character, which is even more annoying.
I love the model. Who is the character that never dies with the painting?
Dorian Gray.
Dorian Gray.
Yeah, I actually I appreciate him explaining his, because I had no idea who the fuck he was and what how
he would. Oh, he had one really really good line in this movie though.
Out of 2.5 hours, he said something smart for 4 seconds. Go ahead.
When Max. They do this, when they do the gramophone to reveal the plot, you know, M is like, oh yeah, M is the villain. There's a wolf in the fold, and it cuts to Dorian Gray. Growl. And that was hilarious.
And you know how to do some quick.
So that earned 3 stars from there. Matt on Letterboxd.
Would it surprise you if I told you that Dorian Gray was a novel by Oscar Wilde and that Oscar Wilde was a very gay man?
No, it doesn't surprise me. And this is the same, this is Oscar Meyer Wiener, same guy?
Yes. Of the yep, Oscar, yes. Because people Oscar. Are related by their first name in England. But I will Except say, if you
Oscar not, Wilde was Irish, I think
he was
Irish.
Yeah, which is why they gave him Stuart Townsend, a man who is technically Irish, but he's doing an English accent here. I will also say, just throwing it out there, if you have not read A Portrait of Dorian Gray, it's good and it's like 80 pages. It's a good quick read.
Really homoerotic, and the growl scene is pretty much the only thing in this movie that acknowledges that.
Exactly.
I never got gay vibes off that. I thought it was just him being a smartass, because Oscar Wilde was a gigantic smartass.
In the book, he's both. In the book, you get big gay vibes.
When he came to America, he's like, anything to declare? And he's like, my genius.
I will also just throw out here, he is played by a man named Stuart Townsend. We've covered Stuart Townsend before, where he played... Lestat in the Queen of the Damned movie, not the original, but the one where it's like the new metal version. But most famously, they hired him to be Wolverine in X-Men, and they fired him and replaced him with Hugh Jackman, which of course we will all agree was by far the best choice. So instead, he did those movies. He was then hired to be Fandral in Thor. So he was going to be in Thor, and then they also fired him from that. And so apparently he's a very difficult actor to work with.
He was in the movie version of Aeon Flux.
Oh, good. Which is apparently unwatchable. So I guess we'll get there one day. Maybe have nothing else to watch. You'll, I guess, most likely see him apparently in episodes of nothing. He's not in anything.
No, he had his chance at superstardom, and he did not take it.
Yes.
In the early thousands, I can't imagine. You know what I mean? Like, no internet, but it's still kind of technology. Ugh. Cocaine.
Pre-social media, the world is probably significantly improved in many ways.
I mean, yeah.
Thanks, Grandpa.
I mean, no, that's a point. I mean, like, you guys don't remember that was the boom of the reality shows. Like, they legit gave Flavor Flav a show.
They did. Flavor.
Oh, yeah.
Flavor.
You think we don't remember?
You think we don't?
Mr. Jeanette, there was too many R's in that. I think it was Flavor of Love.
Proper English. It's just like, you know, Enron, it's a weird time. No, but back to this movie. No, I that cutscene, that black and white, that you mentioned, Matt, that was actually probably my favorite part of the movie, because like it, not that I was bored, even though the chase and the fighting scene that they had in the city, it was pretty cool, the CGI effects with the vampires. But that was when, like, I guess it made sense to me. Like, because up until that point, me personally, I was still fucking confused. Even after watching that, I was still confused. But it was a cool, like, midpoint, check. Like, okay, I know who the villains are, the true villains are, and who, you know, who they fight against, that sort of thing. So, yeah. If.
Look, okay. I can nitpick this movie scene by scene all day. Like, the opening with the tank that's robbing the Bank of England might have worked, but does nothing to introduce the world that we're actually in, where all fiction is true. The recruitment scene with Quartermain is boring. Let's skip ahead about when they're in Venice.
Well, I was going to say, right away, what they should have done is take a character that we all recognize, perhaps. Maybe Sherlock Holmes. Just give someone a Deerstalker hat. Have him at the site chasing down the tank and then dying, and that is the onus for us creating a new league.
Yes, that perfect. That would have been great.
It's so simple. Like, it's really not hard. And I mean, let's be honest, the average American has no idea who Alan Quartermain is.
Nope.
And frankly, I've seen those movies, and it still took me a second, because those are the most forgettable of movies. You could find an English character, they're already referencing Moriarty. You could do Sherlock Holmes. Just have someone with a Deerstalker hat and a hunter's cloak running after the tank, and it turns and blows him up. Pow! We have our intrigue. And they can just say, Agent Holmes is down. We need a new league.
And the fact that it's Holmes makes perfect sense when we talk about how the fact the villain's Moriarty is meant to be a twist.
Yes. Right. And then it makes all the more sense in the world. But he can say that we died at Rickenbach Falls instead of I died at Rickenbach Falls. Ooh.
True. I will say this. That recruitment scene, and I know you guys get a kick out of this, but let me say this. If it was a montage, like a nice little 80 montage, where they come up and like, oh, you son of a bitch, and just did that, you know, that freeze frame they got prepped, like Back to the Predator, you know, just like that one. I think that's a 2 minute scene right there. Everybody. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like, so Sherlock Holmes is killed hanging from Phineas Fogg's balloon. And then we enter a scene wherein Quartermain is exploded. Well, his bars exploded in literally the worst explosion sequence I've ever seen, because they literally just superimpose fire over this house and then it's burning later. They couldn't get the explosion.
Oh, boy.
But Quartermain decides, all right, if it's for the Empire, I'll go help the Queen. Fine. So we go to our round room where we're introduced to M, who's assigning stuff. We're introduced to Mina Harker, who's announced as a chemist, though this is one thing that I'll bring up that Daniel brought up. In the book, she's actually the leader. And it would have been interesting if, you know, because eventually it comes out that she had a previous relationship with Dorian Gray. So the idea, and if you watch the video of this, I don't know if I'll post it, we're all in picture frames now. I thought that was appropriate, so that in years later, I can see myself getting older.
And my camera's not on, so I can avoid that fate, unlike Dorian Gray.
That's right. But like, the whole notion of Dorian Gray is that, like, eventually he's the shitheel who... whatever. But it would have been interesting if, as the leader, she is kind of re-seduced by him, which is why she doesn't want to accuse him of anything. But instead, none of that matters. It's just a dropped story thread. And again, if you're writing stories about this kind of stuff, if it doesn't matter, cut it from your script. The fact that they're kind of lovers comes back in repartee during their fight scene, but it could just solve all these little plot issues.
Well, it explains how he got some things from her later. And that's why she wants him to kill him so bad.
He takes her blood at one point.
Yeah.
Which is what makes someone a vampire. in the Dracula lore. In not all lores, in most lores, but in Dracula specifically. All right, so now Daniel, I'm keying you up so you can tell us what happens in Venice. But essentially, what's determined is in a last ditch effort to prevent what will be World War One in nigh on like a decade and a half from when this movie takes place, all the leaders of Europe are supposedly meeting in Venice, including the British Prime Minister, the King, and the Prime Minister and Bismarck. Otto von Bismarck of Germany, several of the minor kings of Europe and the Grand Dukes are all supposed to be meeting in Venice. And the belief is that whomever, presumably the Phantom, is going to destroy that and kill all the leaders, which will lead to the war itself. Take us away, Daniel.
Well, in the opening scene where the Bank of England is robbed, it's with a tank that shouldn't exist, and everyone on the tank is speaking German. So Britain concludes, oh, this is a military action by Germany. We want to declare war on you. And the meeting in Venice is meant to prevent that. But the Phantom, again, how very operatic, is there and wants to essentially destroy Venice to destroy the talks and thereby have the war happen sooner, because as Matt said, he's a war profiteer. But these Venice scenes, nothing about them makes sense. I mean, we've got a what's essentially an aircraft carrier going through the canals. There's a whole scene where people who don't know what a car is are driving cars and trying to aim a flare at the same time.
Automobile.
Yes. And I think the worst of it is half the city is still destroyed, and then there's a moment where Sean Connery's trying to hunt the Phantom in a non-existent Venetian graveyard. There's a lot of groundwater in Venice, so they bury their dead in crypts, not in graves. And he's like going, Venice still stands. And oh my God, it's like, no, it doesn't. It clearly does not.
I want to talk about, I know the car chase scene, but specifically the car. I don't know the point of reference. It just seems like a very long car. And I've never been to Venice, but I know it's in watching movies that you need small little like Mini Coopers and Fiats. So I will agree with you on this, Daniel. I like seeing them fucking Tokyo Drift on the small narrow streets, not really streets, fucking sidewalks, like there's canals and waters between us. Venice did really like tell myself, like, come on, that's
you know, if they really wanted to be in the spirit of the source material or to fix this big plot hole, they could have just said we're going to the meeting in Laputa, which is one of the places in Gulliver's Travels. That really would have made sense. They could have just made up whatever they wanted to about that city, and nobody could question it because it doesn't exist. Why not do that?
That's true. That is true. If it's a reference to it, yeah. But I guess Venice, it's water. You have a submarine. I guess would it justify the submarine, though?
I guess, but I mean, again, if you're working with something that's fictional like Laputa, then they could say it's a coastal city. Who cares? I mean, I believe in Gulliver's Travels, it was a floating island.
I'm sure there could have been some type of balloon in that submarine, because holy shit, like, again, like I said earlier, if Liberace had a submarine, that would be it. So wait, who had bankrolled all this, by the way? What, for everybody? What, did it come from that one character?
Who bankrolled it?
Yeah. Well, did all
It was technically a secret organization created by the British government, so.
But wasn't explained that all of it was fake, though?
Well, I mean, M tricked them, which also doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but that's so the big twist halfway through.
Thinking about it, don't think about it. Because you're thinking
about me?
It. Yeah, you don't think about it. No, because it makes no sense. If M really wanted to, say, undermine them, he should have found shitty characters. Like, there was, like, three Smurfs, Captain Haddock from Tintin. Like, they just get no one. Why would he get... I'm going to find the best of the best in order for them to fail. I've been drinking since dawn. I'm not afraid to slap a woman. Thanks, Alan Quartermain. You're the best. Like, why bother? Like, if it really is M trying to undermine them, like, that's why in the Bond movies, when, like, there's a guy in MI5 or a woman in MI5 who's trying to, like, screw it all up, they've got to get Bond back because otherwise there's no one left to trust. Like, the idea that the guy who's doing the thing is the guy who's evil is incredibly stupid. You're right. Like, I'm going to fund
why? Okay, so he's assembling them and we're skipping ahead of Venice so that he can steal parts of them to create new weapons and be, like Matt said, a war profiteer. Okay, why set them up as a league together where they can defeat you? Why not just meet them individually or have someone else do that and then take the Invisible Man's cells, take Mina's blood, I don't know, take Quartermain's special rifles?
Yeah. It would be more interesting if it happened in reverse, where they were separate and Quartermain is someone who smells something afoot. Like, wait a minute. That bloke who invented the invisibility formula was killed and his stuff was stolen. That's suspicious. You know, that Mr. Hyde is gone and Dr. Jekyll is claiming his lab had been robbed. That's suspicious. That chemist, Mina Harker, says her lab has been robbed. That's suspicious. I'm also proving the fact that all of these are the exact same story, which is kind of dumb. But at the same time, like, that's more interesting if Quartermain is the one who calls them together because he smells a rat. I think these things are connected. That's also a better story. And again,
yes,
if you're going to ignore a lot of the graphic novel, just go ahead and simplify it.
That's true.
Yeah. Okay.
There's a lot of stupid we didn't cover. We didn't cover Dorian Gray's introduction, where they go to his house and then a bunch of Germans show up and machine gun him, but he's impervious to bullets. We're missing the scenes.
I just want to point out, remember, he was supposed to be Wolverine. And so him being shot with a bunch of bullets and then him effectively spitting the bullets out as he heals with healing factor is just the Wolverine thing from the first two movies.
He was practicing.
It is.
Yeah.
See, I could have done it, Stan.
Before we get to the third act, I do want to mention the one reference that works.
Okay.
And it's a scene with Quartermain and Mina. I keep wanting to call her Mina Maria. Mina Harker. Where they're talking and eventually Quartermain, as Sean Connery's like, I've had woman on my past exploits and found him at best to be a distraction. That is a great Bond reference.
True.
Yeah.
Well,
that's the only thing that works here.
I mean, I will give it to one other thing, which is when he first shows up in M's office, he assumes that Sean Connery wants a drink, which to me is also kind of right in the same vein. What's his name? He throws the Invisible Man against a hat rack. So M has an office with both a hat rack and the liquor cabinet, which would be right out of M's office in a Bond movie. So, you know, there are some details here. But if I had to guess, which I am because I'm in charge of a podcast, and I don't do research and I barely watch these movies. But if I had to, I would guess that the director wanted more of this stuff. And by committee, they said, no, you got to make it simpler so other people can understand it.
Feel like we're in that episode of The Simpsons where Lisa has to watch just slideshows all day about how we'll colonize the moon in 1970 or whatever it was. And when she goes to complain to Principal Skinner, it's like, well, if I did that, then the stupid kids would complain.
Right. Which, again, it only sucks because... I mean, again, Matt and I can quibble over this, but it at least didn't make enough money to make a sequel. This would have been a better miniseries made nowadays, something on FX or HBO, where you could do it slower and have an episode with just Quartermain, and then they add someone else in the second episode.
Yeah, that would be fun.
Don't say that. Might reboot it.
All right, so
there's been talk of rebooting it already.
Oh shit!
Shall I hit up the almighty Wikipedia?
No, don't do that.
The AI picked up that we were going to record the podcast, and they said, "Like, hey, people are talking about it."
That's right. There's one podcast dumb enough to talk about it on what is its 20th anniversary, almost exactly.
It might be. There in May 2022. There's the reboot they're talking about doing on Hulu with some guy named Justin Haith writing it. Producer Don Murphy is returning, and Susan Motfort and Erwin Stoff.
Now,
I don't even know who most of these people are.
I will say,
I mean, it kind of already was a TV show, and that's Penny Dreadful.
Yeah.
Well, I will say,
yeah.
I know you guys are fans of The Simpsons, and so therefore you are a fan of Futurama, if I'm not mistaken, and they do have a new episode coming out, which very reflects the current situation in Hollywood right now. So AI is real, and it might pick up this episode. So I'm saying it right now. If the reboot has happened, it's our fault.
There you go.
You were going to say something, Nick?
Well, first of all, this is almost exactly the 20th anniversary, and it doesn't hold up a bit. But I was going to say, what would be more interesting, since they don't care about much of the original material, is what if they did something akin to an American version of this? What would our League of Extraordinary Gentlemen be? And we could even bump it forward. We could set it in like the 40s or something, because I think Indiana Jones would be an interesting character. And if we're doing the 40s and it's just this nonfiction or these fiction characters.
The Shadow.
Shadow would be interesting. Yeah. We could do, if we're doing the 40s, we could do Batman and or Superman. And by that point, we're getting a little bit too superpowered, because the whole point was that he wanted to do... Go ahead.
This is interesting. So, okay, we put this in America. So we take the Huck Finn Tom Sawyer character to America, and let's just talk about American literature characters in that same time period, right? Within the 40s, you know. So who would be that? I'm not the educator here, so I'll lean on to that. What popular characters were there American based?
Well,
if it were me, I would add someone like Sam Spade, you know, do like a Dashiell Hammett noir character, you know, because like just make it black and white, make him gritty, make it like snooty. I don't know. Like our literary background is completely different. I mean, go ahead.
I got you. Let's do this. Let's hypothetical this. Okay. So what this is based in, what's it? What's the year? This is based on World War.
Because like this one comes out in 1899.
Okay, so let's do this. Let's take the America part of it. Tom Sawyer is the founder of the U.S. literary organization. And we got people like Nancy Drew, the Hardy Boys,
Natty Bumpo. I'm sure would be there.
Yeah, Bedelia's just the bitch who ruins everything.
And then our cue would be that dude in the cartoonist, the one that with the glasses and
Mr. Peabody.
Yeah. Oh God, you should really hear
the dog.
Yeah, the dog. They would be like some type of like. It'd be based off. What else? Fucking Garfield would be
Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Okay.
Daniel, this is where you come in.
So. There actually was a spoof created back in the day where they announced a 1998 American version of the League. It included the following: Dr. Emmett Brown.
Good.
Jack Burton from Big Trouble in Little China.
Okay.
B.A. Baracus from A-Team.
Okay.
So Mr. T.
Mr. T.
Okay. Angus MacGyver.
Yeah, MacGyver, okay.
And Lisa from Weird Science.
Oh, I thought you were going to say for The Simpsons.
No.
Actually, you know who'd have been a good one? You know who'd have been a good one? The $3 million man.
Ooh. The $6 million, you mean?
$6 man. Sorry, adjusting for inflation.
Oh.
$3 million nowadays, he just has a replacement hip.
According to, as Matt put it, the almighty Wikipedia, the 1988 league was the supposed successor to another league disbanded in 1979 by Oscar Goldman,
okay,
who is the $6 million man.
There you go. Okay.
The 88 league was created after the murder of Mr. Miyagi to prevent a resurrected Tony Montana and his occult gang, the Lost Boys, from killing all those between him and domination of America. See, God, you know,
I like it so much. I like the idea so that the token fun. Black character is literally Shaft. Like, I just.
It's so much fun to think about these alternatives, though. I mean, how would the modern league be?
Add in Dolomite, and then I'd watch it.
Okay, so who would a modern league be in 2023? Jesus Christ.
Egner Allan Poe. Modern.
Modern. I mean, think Jason Bourne would be the Alan Quartermain character.
Yeah, he's a good one to pick. He's a good pick.
Jack Ryan.
Jack Ryan would be good.
I hate to say it, but if we're looking for a modern Mina Harker character, that's Bella Swan.
I have a correction. I would say Eleven from Stranger Things.
Ooh, yes. Oh,
even better, even better, even better.
Just so we work the Terminator in somehow?
Terminator yes, would be not? Interesting. Yeah. And their wheelman can be a baby from Baby Driver.
Oh,
there you go.
Yep, yeah. Yep. Yeah, no.
No, it would be Vin Diesel's character in The Fast and the Furious.
Yes, it would. Yeah, Toretto. It'd be a yep. Toretto.
Big Toretto. It's all about family.
Who's the nerd? I mean, if we could go animated, I would go for Frank, but I don't know if we can.
Frank.
Now, Rick Moranis is too far. Oh, just go back to the Ghostbusters. Our occult guy is Dan Aykroyd. We got to go.
yeah, something superficial that can speak to it. You gotta have a stoner in there somewhere.
And because we're being funny and tongue in cheek, the president of the United States who sent them on mission has to be Arnold Schwarzenegger talking about the glory days.
Yeah,
we have to go straight mm-hmm. there.
That's two Simpsons. That's two Simpsons.
It is two Simpsons.
Yeah, that's two Simpsons. You gotta put up a. What about
The Simpsons? Could Homer Simpson be worked in there somehow?
Probably.
How about
maybe Bart?
No. He's there, but we don't see him. He's like Charlie from Charlie's Angels. He's just a voice coming out of a box, giving the mission. He's the voice of Kit.
What about Action Jackson himself?
Ooh.
Oh, I kind of like it. But he plays someone like Face from A-Team, so he just switches through the various characters he's played on TV.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like he always just plays like different action black guys from like his entire filmography. Like,
I love it.
Because you can't do Samuel anymore, because now that he's in charge of the Avengers, it's kind of ruined the bit. It's the same bit. Like, that's what that Secret Wars thing is now.
So, you know, if they really wanted to be clever, they could introduce a character talking about what it takes to be a double agent, and that's Special Agent Sean Archer from Face Off.
That's a good one. I mean, who they're trying to take down is Project Mayhem from Fight Club.
There you go. But again, this is all way more fun than the movie. And I remember being on IMDb message boards where this would be in the entire conversation, like, who today would be in the league, which is a lot of fun. There's no fun in this movie because they've neutered the characters so much and just turned them into archetypes instead of using the characters to comment on those archetypes.
Well, and the problem, too, is several of them have very similar powers. What's the major difference between Alan Quatermain and Tom Sawyer? Tom Sawyer shoots too quickly and too often. Great. Mina Harker and Dorian Gray are both immortals. Great. Like, you could have picked almost any character because through the league, there's been a whole bunch, right? That's something that I think the Avengers did very well. They picked people with different powers, and I know he's a scumbag, but what Bryan Singer did very well with the first two X-Men movies and then four and five with the X-Men movies. He made it so that the X-Men that were included each had different powers that could be used in different ways, so they all mattered to the plot. Here, just there in the final fight scene, Sean Connery's gone for like 20 minutes. And then he reappears to make a shot because that's all he's good for, shooting and throwing a good right hook. Who cares? Like, make these people matter, or it's his story the whole time. You gotta pick. Speaking of, someone who would be in this league is definitely Canadian James T. Kirk.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, James T. Kirk was born in Iowa, so.
That's true. I have nothing to apologize about. Anyway, so. We've already talked about the end of this, which is that it turns out that Moriarty was M, and he's the villain who did everything for no reason.
Dorian Gray was the double agent. M recruited the League in order to steal all their powers so that he could turn them into weapons and sell them to the fighting countries during the World War. They end up in, I'll just call it Siberia. I forget exactly where it is.
It's accessible by sea, so it probably is Siberia.
And then there's this whole final fight where some people have been taken hostage, and the Invisible Man has to help them, and then Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde have to like smash through the facility, and there's this huge thing with like a supercharged henchman going full Hyde, which looks like dog shit, by the way. The CGI is terrible. Hey. And then, actually, the Invisible Man is going there to plant bombs to destroy the facility. And I had this as Hyde saves the prisoners, but my phone auto-corrected that to Elmo.
Not the whole bottle!
There's the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. There, Elmo has to be involved.
Yes, him and Big Bird.
Elmo has split personality.
Also, this is how bad the movie is in terms of its references. There's a scene where a henchman calls M Professor, and then I believe there's a scene where Dorian calls him James. So Professor James. It's like, all right. That's fine. But then during the final confrontation, Sean Connery's like, or should I call you Moriarty? It's like, I already get it.
But also,
you don't need to keep explaining it.
Well, yes, or you need to see him figure it out. It just kind of happens. Like, there's so much in this movie where scenes deleted, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, there are deleted scenes, I think. I think it's referenced that Huck Finn got murdered.
No.
I think you're right, Matt, but it's all just, I don't know, even with deleted scenes based on everything, I don't know how you could have saved this.
Maybe there was studio interference maybe there was this beautiful movie that could have been franchised and the studio just wanted, they basically did what, what was that movie that was based off a Stephen King novel with the towers?
Oh, The Dark Tower.
It's The Dark Tower. I don't know if y'all saw it.
I did.
Matt loves that movie.
He loves
the series.
I will say this. The series, the novel, they smushed in three books in one movie. And I'll only say that about that movie. But essentially, tying it back to the league, sure, there was a lot of studio interference. They wanted to just smash everything in because maybe they knew it was going to be a shitty movie. So they just said, fuck it. let we have to burn through this for tax reasons or what, whatever. But yeah, there's probably like, you know, the Connery cut of this movie that's like really good, and that we, you know, it's lost in the vault. Who bankrolled, who's the studio of this movie?
20th Century.
Which tells you a lot, because for Disney to own this and it not be available, you Amazon Prime, you can have this Disney movie. That tells you a lot, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so we're at the end scene here. Doctor Who is fighting Hooper. Eamon Goth is trying to take down Cookie Monster. E.T. the Extraterrestrial, of course, is fighting Miss Piggy. And everyone has paired off as they're trying to bring down the We're having
no,
fun.
No, I mean, you're right. The League splits up. They each accomplish different things. And then Em and Sawyer are going to confront Em. Also, Dorian Gray is killed when Mina makes him look at his portrait, which, again, okay, that makes sense for the world that they've built, but the way it's handled is really dumb. And also, it's like, okay, then he betrayed the League because he wanted his picture back, but if he can't look at it, what's the point?
Yeah, but here's also the stupid thing. You don't have to make him sympathetic. The idea that Moriarty is hiding his portrait from him, threatening his life. I don't need to like Dorian Gray at the end of this. It's okay to just have a villain, guys. Like, And I know this is now Marvel's character problem and the Disney animated movie's character problem. Everyone has to have a deep, dark, like, something we understand them for. Fine. This is a superhero movie, and sometimes you just need to get Lex Luthor. Sometimes the Joker needs to just get arrested. He doesn't have to have a simple side. And by the way, I know this is an Alan Moore thing, but still, like, God damn it, that pissed me off so much. I'm like, don't make me feel sorry for Dorian Gray. I don't care.
Yeah,
I don't care. You know.
We're supposed to feel sorry for Dorian Gray. He's just he's just smug the whole time.
Yes, but Moriarty is threatening his life, right? Yeah. The only reason he's on Moriarty's side is because Moriarty has control of the portrait that will kill him if it's destroyed. That's the only reason why he does it.
That's a flaw there. I mean, it's just like go away.
That's right. Meanwhile,
yeah, okay. I can't look at my portrait or else I'll die. Take it away from me, please.
That's right. Yep. Meanwhile, yeah. You know, Ed from Good Burger is fighting Flo from the insurance commercials. And, like, the whole world is collapsing on top of us. You know, Benedict Cumberbatch is fighting as both Doctor Strange and Sherlock Holmes. And, like, the world is crashing down. I'm just having fun now. Okay. Biff Tannen is sucker punching Noob Saibot from the Mortal Kombat movie.
Ooh, Jason Michael J. Fox is fighting Jason Bateman within the what was it?
And they're both his wolves.
Yes, oh, yes. Team Wolf 2 versus Team Wolf.
That would be the smallest wolf fight of all time. And then the guys from American Werewolf in London just show up, and they're 3 feet taller than them.
And that one guy, previous episode, which was that one shot, just kills everyone. That one, it's that Thanos snap.
Okay, and then Jason Bateman as Teen Wolf kills Michael J. Fox as Teen Wolf, and then they have to fight Bateman from American Psycho. And then...
Oh, there you go. There's a good villain for the 2000s League. Patrick Bateman showing up in the Emerald.
Well, but that's it. Like, and then you have, again, the characters from Fight Club would be great. You know,
you have
and just because
King.
I'm reading... Go ahead.
You have Stephen King, and he just has a blank hit. He got a mythical book. He got that book from Hocus Pocus, right? And the Butch book with the eye. And he has the ability to write or draw anything he has in fruition, rip it out, and it appears.
Yeah, girl. That's a good one.
Yo, this could actually, just think about it. We're not thinking broadly. Imagine fight scenes from Anchorman. right? And you just have this bunch of people just like crowded around like that, you know what I mean? And it's all these, right, you know what I mean? And like, I just, yeah, I'm getting way ahead of myself. But yeah, no, this.
And instead of M, it's Rod Sterling from the Twilight Zone, who starts out with the beginning, is like, all right, picture a world wherein a science fiction and horror writer's world is coming to life. I need a group of men and women from literature to put down the story.
You know, if Stephen King, they'd have to stop him right away because otherwise he had like hundreds of critters coming out of his notebook.
You know what?
Matt, you got to think of him like Rita Repulsa from Power Rangers. He's releasing one at a time and trying to stop the world.
Only
I'm guessing he doesn't have the Madonna bra.
Nope.
I mean, but also he could have the Madonna bra.
And the and this is going to be the kicker. This is the Dennis Quaid going up into the mothership in Independence Day. You know, the only thing that could defeat the people who save the world is everyone from the cast of Jackass.
Yeah, there you go.
Yes,
Steve-O's like, guys, one more for the fans, and then he just goes off. And for those of you who don't know it, look up the Ultimate Showdown for Ultimate Destiny on YouTube or whatever.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That brings back memories there.
Meanwhile, this shit just kind of ends. Alan Quartermain gets stabbed through the spine by Moriarty, who is then shot by Huck Finn or Tom Sawyer or whoever white guy's left.
Tom Sawyer is who he shot by using a technique Quartermain showed him earlier when they were skeet shooting on the Nautilus.
And then he has to find his next guide, his next Miyagi, which is Pac-Man, so he can fight the space invaders, which get high on you.
If only.
Anyway, so with Quartermain dead, they all go to Africa, where Tom Sawyer reminds us that Africa would never let Alan Quartermain die. And I'm no expert, but the end of this seems to get kind of racist. First of all, just for those of you who are writing a script at home, not all of Africa is just Africa. And so this guy, I don't know where in the American Southwest they filmed this, but it just looks like a desert, you know, with like an old West series of grave markers, which we presume is all the people who are serving the white Englishmen who died in the fire.
Well, one of them is Quartermain's son because you see the name on it.
Yes. Was Quartermain's son supposed to be the phantom behind the mask?
No, that's M.
Then why was his face scarred up?
Maybe he bounced off Reichenbach Falls a couple times. He was falling down.
But we see his face regular every other scene where M is.
Well,
I thought the guy behind the mask was supposed to be Quartermain's son.
You're thinking about it.
No.
No, I get you. Because at one point, Moriarty says, remember what happened to your son, and then he holds up the mask after someone else has died. That's why I thought it.
Doesn't M like put on some kind of prosthetic or something? Like, I remember him taking something out of his mouth.
Yeah, because in that graveyard scene, when he got pushed into a grave, the mask fell off, and then there was like kind of these prosthetics.
Fair enough. It's all stupid. Anyway, Quartermain is buried with the corpses of his six wives, his son, his several mistresses, all the servants who died in the fire. And then this guy comes out of what I'm going to assume was just a coloring book. I don't know, man. He's just dancing and shaking.
A literal witch doctor.
Because Quartermain referenced a witch doctor earlier, so maybe it's that guy.
True.
I'm sure it is. And then it becomes a Sting music video as the sun sets and the clouds stream overhead, and it keeps zooming in on this rifle. And I told my wife, who had come in for the last several minutes and said, this looks dumb. I'm like, you're right. And it zoomed him on this rifle. And I said, if the hand reaches out and grabs the rifle, I might break the TV. Now, luckily it didn't, but it was close. It was close.
Very close.
Well, it looks like they're pretty obviously setting up for him to come back, which didn't happen because they never made a sequel.
It didn't make enough money. It just didn't. Oh, God, this was awful. I'll just go first because, Daniel, you get to go last because this is your choice.
All right.
I had more fun talking about it than I did watching it. About 4 or 5 minutes in, maybe 6 minutes in, when the guy blew up the drinking establishment with a bomb, a huge bomb. And the special effect of the fire looked better in the 1930s. I knew this was not going to be a good film. There are some moments with interesting effects. Like the first time the Invisible Man puts on a coat and does his face up, I think that looks good. The drive through Venice where they're destroying the town, I think that looks good. There's some interesting ideas here. But overall, this movie was a mess. And it seems like it was a top-down mess. Like the script was noted to death, the effects were noted to death, and the movie just fell flat. Nor, go ahead.
I wanted to like this movie when I recently watched it because I just remember, like you said, Nick, I just remember it having a lot of style. I remember it having a lot of flair. But it, as I'm older and as, you know, I continue to, you know, to be on this podcast and, you know the difference between good movies and bad movies, I do miss I do see where there was a pacing issue, as Nick, as you mentioned. I do see where things, and I will disagree that chase in Venice with the long ass car, the laws of physics does not make sense. Like I said, you know, we out here with Mini Coopers, but you have like a 100-yard car, Tokyo drifting next to canals. But like I said before, this would have been a dope movie if it focused on the individual characters rather than Justice League with Josh Wheaton force it and just expect us to know everything. But, you know, brownie points for at least making the action scenes look cool. You know what I mean? So that's my take.
Matt?
Okay. The Dark Tower movie was mentioned. So I'll compare the two. As an adaptation of the source material, it doesn't sound like it's that great, neither of them. But if Dark Tower is a good fantasy with rifles movie, and this is just a fun kind of steampunk Avengers if you don't think about it too much.
Mm.
So, I mean, it's fun to watch, but it's not great. I don't hate it like they do. And I do like the idea Nick had of making it. Is there Nick or Noor who said make it a TV show?
That was Nick.
Oh.
I will add, just because we were there earlier, but I agree with some of the steampunk stuff. I don't generally like the steampunk aesthetic for a lot of reasons, but like the guys with the flamethrowers looked cool. And the guys with the body armor in the Old West gear, that was a cool idea. They blew up a hangar of dirigibles, so someone blew their load right then. But I just feel like it didn't tie together in any way. Good ideas are fine, but you still have to tell a story. Daniel, take us home.
All righty. Well, if you're really interested in this material, read the comics, or even better, read the source material that all these characters are from. Go read Dracula. Go read Tom Sawyer. Go do all of that. The way this movie works, it's just, it's so dumb. It treats the audience with such contempt and doesn't expect anybody to get the jokes or get the references. It's like, why build a world based on that if you're not going to trust the audience to look deeper? This movie is so shallow. The characters are so one-dimensional. The script is so cliched. I mean, maybe I liked the bits in the shootouts where, in like Dorian Gray's library, where you'd see the pages from the shot books fall down. That was kind of John Woo. That looked cool, but that's about it. I mean, I just can't really think of anything about this movie that actually worked. And it's such a fun premise too. I mean, we were playing the game about who would be in a modern day league, and that's a lot of fun to discuss. But that fun just does not translate into this movie. And God, I wish it had been more fun.
But yeah, so, you know, whoever owns these rights now, which might be no one, consider reaching out to us. We'll come up with a few different series and maybe like the new Beavis and Butthead, just jump through time and have different leagues at different times doing different. Anyway, as we continue.
That is amusing, Nick.
It would be
that fun. Is amusing and satirical.
Very humorous. Very humorous.
Very humorous.
As we continue this Dantastic month, we invite you next week to do one I had never even, you'll hear, but I'd seen clips of, but had never seen entirely before, a little John Candy movie called Armed and Dangerous. So continue doing all you do to keep us on the charts. Keep sharing us on the socials, which Matt say the world would be better without. Which, if you're listening to this when it comes out, means you probably don't need to be following him for the time. Just give us some reviews. We haven't gotten any reviews in a while. Though you're still listening, I can see the numbers. Some of you are still listening. We're on the top of the charts in Israel this week. So there you have it. So, ladies and gentlemen, while you're protesting, consider listening to a new episode. Thanks for doing it.
We good.
Yeah, right. Thanks, everyone. We're out. Myopia Movies is a podcast production of Dude Letter Podcasting and is produced by Nick Hoffman. It is edited by Ner Trinette and Daniel Suttis and is hosted by Nick Hoffman with production assistance by Matthew Quinn, Daniel Suttis, and Ner Trinette. The theme song is Surf Shimmy by Kevin MacLeod from incomptech.com. Licensed under the Creative Commons by Attribution 4 license, Creative Commons /licenses /4.0. Thanks.